Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. I'd like right now to welcome Craig Barnes. He's the author of the book, In Search of the Lost Feminine, Myths That Radically Reshaped Civilization. And he is going to be doing a benefit tomorrow night, participating in a benefit at the College of Santa Fe Forum at 7 o'clock. And it's a benefit for the Girls' School. And I'd like to welcome Lee Lewin, who's the Educational Director and co-founder of the Girls' School as well. Welcome.
Thank you.
Lee, first of all, tell us a little bit about the Girls' School. You are the co-founder.
The Girls' School is a middle school. Four girls. We founded it in 1999 and graduated our first class of eighth grade students in 2000. We started as a seventh and eighth grade middle school, and we are now a sixth, seventh, and eighth grade middle school. Our educational philosophy is based on Socratic seminar style education, and we feel that all our subject matter, all our content areas are related to one another. So we teach in order to connect, to help our students make connections.
Why did you choose to found a girls' school instead of a co-ed school?
I had been teaching in the public schools, and I was teaching at the fifth and sixth grade levels, and I saw that gender politics starts very early in our culture. And
I think at birth, no?
I think at birth. I think that's right. And it is intensifying as the years go on because of our media. And the gender politics interfere with both boys and girls learning. I thought that if the girls and the boys could be separated, that, and for me, I was interested in working with girls, being a woman myself, I thought it would give the girls the opportunity to not compete for male attention. It is the competition for the male attention that seems to support girls in inappropriate or unproductive behaviors that include everything from acting out socially to becoming silent and non-participatory in the classroom.
Do they have, is it all female teachers as well?
It is not. We have one male teacher who is teaching our environmental science program, and in the past we have had a male music teacher. Most of us are women, however.
And it's, since it's a private school, presumably a pretty small school, you need to be doing benefits like this to raise money.
Yes. We cap our population at 45. We feel that having a small school site as well as small school classrooms is one of the keys to excellence in developing skills and in success for our students.
So the other thing is, why did you choose that particular age group, that sort of very young pre-adolescent to adolescent?
Because that's where girls in particular start developing ideas of what they're capable of, developing ideas of who they are as individuals, and it's an easier arena for them to recognize their full potential when they are with just girls than when they are in an arena where they are competing for attention with boys and competing with other girls for the attention of the boys.
So do you find that when you observe the classroom, it really is a non-competitive atmosphere?
It is a non-competitive atmosphere. It's interesting, when our students come in the sixth grade, having come in from public elementary school, we recruit from public elementary schools, and we expect that most of our students will go into public high school as leaders. We want to fill that window in between elementary and public high school. Many of our sixth graders come in very competitive, assuming that that is the key to success. And we spend a lot of the sixth grade year helping them to understand that we want them to look at their own potential and what their own learning curve is instead of somebody else's. We work in a seminar style, so everybody has the opportunity to contribute to the conversation.
So when they go back into high school, you've probably had enough students returning. There are probably some who've already graduated from high school.
Absolutely.
Or are in that process.
Mm-hmm.
How does it prepare them for going back into the jungle or the state of nature or whatever that is the Santa Fe Public Schools?
Our curriculum is based on expression. We expect our students to develop their ability to speak, to identify what they know and then speak what they know, and to identify and write what they know. So they become really skilled self-advocates. When they go into the public school system, they're pretty clear about what they want. Their academic skill level is very high, and they have the tools they need to get the courses that they want, which are generally AP courses by the time they're in 10th and 11th grades, and be very successful. And we have students, graduates from the Santa Fe Girls School, who are now juniors at the college level, and they're doing very, very well.
Do you teach, I was thinking about this because looking at Craig Barnes' book, which has all these amazing pictures of Minoan art, are you teaching art as well?
We do teach art. Our sixth grade students experiment with a lot of different forms of fine art. Our seventh grade students are in a structured black and white drawing program where they learn portraiture, they learn still life, they learn landscape perspective. And then our eighth grade works in color the whole year, and they work in pastel, watercolor, and acrylics.
So if people want to find out more about the Girls' School, do you have a website?
We do have a website. It's www.santafegirlsschool.org. And we have a telephone, 820-3188. And we're there from 8 in the morning until probably 4 in the afternoon, except today.
Except today, because school is closed.
School is closed.
Yay. Well, anything else you want to let people know about the Santa Fe Girls' School?
I would just like to say that we are in our admissions process right now. We are actively recruiting students to join us at the sixth grade level, and we welcome inquiries and visits to the school.
Lee Lewin is the educational director and co-founder of the Santa Fe Girls' School. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Craig Barnes, you are the author of In Search of the Lost Feminine, Myths That Radically Reshaped Civilization. You published this book a few years ago, but now you're doing some events around it. There's also, besides the event tomorrow night at the College of Santa Fe Forum at 7 o'clock for the Santa Fe Girls' School, there's also a book reading and signing at Body of Santa Fe, which is across the street from us here at the Baking Company in Santa Fe, on the 26th of March at 7 o'clock. How did you embark on the study of Minoan culture and its myths?
You know, Mary Charlotte, I used to try lawsuits. I was a public interest trial lawyer, and I can remember a lawsuit in the 1970s in the Federal District Court in Denver where I was representing Denver's nurses. And I said to the trial judge, I said, look, judge, let me take you back to the nuns who used to, when nurses aren't getting paid as much as tree trimmers. That's not a good deal. Nurses are responsible for human life. They have to measure out the mathematics, they have to do potions and drugs and things like that. They nurture, they analyze, and they're paid less than tree trimmers. How in the world do we get to this state? Let me take you back to show how nuns were paid so little, because nuns used to be nurses. Nuns were primarily nurses. And let me take you back to Florence Nightingale. In fact, judge, let me take you back to the witch burnings. I'll show you why we've got this glass ceiling. And the judge said, no way. We are certainly not going to go do that history in my court. So we didn't. And he ended up ruling that nurses are paid less than tree trimmers because they go home and have babies and break their professional careers, which didn't
seem
bad.
Now, what year was this?
This was 1976.
Ah, yes.
So at that point, what I had, and it was this refusal of the federal judicial system to look at the history. And I thought to myself, boy, would I like to find out where this really comes from. This is misogyny, where a trial judge just assumes that it's natural that highly skilled women would be paid less than parking meter repair people and tree. What's going on here? There's some underlying prejudice. And we're seeing it today in all of the conversation around the Hillary Clinton campaign. There's something going on here that's more than just competence. It's more than just brilliance. So I was asking myself where it came from. And finally, when I stopped practicing law in the 1990s, I was able to go back in the history. And the history took me back to the back to the witch burnings and the Romans and the Greeks. And finally, before the Greeks, we find a culture in which women are celebrated. And I thought to myself, isn't that interesting? And all the wall paintings on the walls and the frescoes and the pots, women are at the center. And they're not being demeaned. They're not being chased around sexually. They're not being exploited sexually. They're actually at the center being honored. They're dressed in glorious costumes. This is way back in 1500 BC. They are being brought gifts by men. They are being on reviewing stands. They're at the top of the reviewing stands when the naval fleet comes in. So what was that? Where did that come from and where did it go to, was the question. What happened to that earlier culture in which the feminine was at the center? And that was so fascinating to me, so such a question. I had to go back to the early biblical writings and then the Greek mythology to discover how that systematically, that culture in which we valued whatever it is we mean by the feminine.
Yeah, what do we mean?
Yeah, we got it's more than just females in charge. It's not just women in charge. There turned out to be a collection of values also in these paintings and figurines, and they had to do with cycles of the seasons, an identification with the ground, things that grow, a reverence for things that go away and come back. Birds, trees, wheat seeds were all central in this archaeology, and they all represented things that could be dependable in their return. So the feminine, the fertility cycle and the moon cycles were stunningly coincident. Same 28-day period, and they honored both of those, so that you could see built into all of this archaeology a reverence for death and life as a combination. Death and life as a combination rather than death as an awful, terrible, ending, dull place. Well, when the Greeks came along, they described death, Hades, as endless, dull, awful. And that was a big, huge shift. So you could see a sense of immortality was in the old culture, and a sense of final death in the new culture, the new Greek culture, the new Hebraic culture. And that was a shift. And then there was a shift about ecstasy. Ecstasy was at the center of this archaeology. Women dancing in the moonlight, dancing on seal rings, dancing on pots. And obviously, sexuality and ecstasy are not the same thing, but they were both honored in these ancient drawings and archaeology, and not at all honored by the Greeks.
Now, how do we know what we know about Minoan culture? There are no written records. We have frescoes and pots. And it seems, and you talk about this in your book, that there is so much subjectivity that one brings to that, and so much of one's own cultural baggage, and even in a case like this, wish to find some golden age.
Yes, that's right. I mean, and there has been a kind of a yearning, looking back for a golden age of prehistory when women were great and men were also great.
Yeah, and that stuff always, I mean, that's like a red flag coming down the pike a mile away when I hear stuff like that.
Yeah, so we have to be very cautious about projecting back. Either way, we also project back that men have always been natural warriors, and the killing is natural, and war is natural, and because it's natural now, and because we are a military culture, that must have been a military culture too. So we have the possibility of projecting our own values back on either side of this debate. So what I said to myself, hey, you've got to do it as you would trying a lawsuit, accumulate the evidence, and see if there's enough of it that points in the same direction, so that instead of just having, when a client comes to the law office, he or she doesn't say, I've got a tort case, or I've got a contract case, or my corporation. They give you facts, and you have to extract from those facts an analysis that adds up to a principle.
Well, I know, but I mean, I thought it was very funny that you said that you approach your work like a trial lawyer, because of course a trial lawyer is trying to make a case and leave out everything that doesn't support their case.
That's right, and you have to be, well, not exactly leave out, but you have to take into account everything that goes both ways. And I try to do that in the book, In Search of the Lost Feminine, to see what the evidence is that runs both directions. And so, for example, when I say that in this book that women were at the center, I had to look at, I looked at hundreds, well, thousands of seal rings in which women were depicted, thousands of images on the walls, thousands of pots and figurines in the British Museum, in Athens, in Crete, in Santorini, and the Los Angeles, over and over. And what you can see is that there is not one scene in all of that of two men fighting, for example.
Whereas on the Greek vases, you have them all over the place.
They're killing women, they're killing each other, they're doing it. It's endless. So there's a different cultural ethic at the center. And to your point, some scholars will say to me, well, we just haven't found yet the evidence of the men fighting in the old Minoan culture, but clearly it was there. And that's one of those dramatic cases of projecting our current values backwards. If it's not there, I say to the judge, this lawyer's saying, well, we're going to find the evidence, Your Honor. Well, I've got thousands of images of women being treated honorably, thousands of images of women at the center. So the evidence that we've got is clearly stronger than the evidence that we might get or that we don't have. So just as a simple matter of presentation of what's out there, there's that kind of thing, that women are clearly being not demeaned. I haven't said in this book, and I don't think we can say, to your point, that this is a matriarchy, that women are in charge. We can't tell that. We can see them at the top of reviewing stands where they're reviewing in, and they're in the central position. Do they have
What's
power?
A reviewing stand?
These big buildings at the edge of the shore with naval ships coming in, and the ships are all coming, and the men are standing along the coastline at the bottom of this fresco. This would be a fresco as long as the wall on the radio cafe in the baking company here. Huge frescoes, and there'll be a man lined up standing at the bottom of this large building, and at the very top will be women who are centrally located. Well, you see that over and over, but you can't say from that they're in charge. You just know they're center. So that's enough to say they're not being raped, they're not being pillaged, they're not being dragged by the hair as they are as soon as we get to the Greek mythology, where the images change dramatically. So as soon as we get to 750 BC or Homer, we start having women being called the Furies or the Sirens or Medea or Medusa, the Sphinx or the Gorgon. The Gorgon will turn a man to stone. Look at me in the Antonin. None of those images are there. So there's something different about the images that the Greeks used. And then the question becomes, why? How come the Greeks shifted images? Why do they go from women at least being benign to women being demonic?
Well, before we get there to why it shifted, let's talk a little bit more about how it was in the Minoan culture. And this is, we're talking about island people, and we're talking about a period of what, about 1,000 years?
The Minoan culture lasted from about 2500 to 1500 BC, so that's about 1,000 years. What it probably, they were island people. They were in Crete and Santorini, what is today called Santorini, and probably at Lesbos and Lernos and other places that were in the islands. Their island cultures are probably the last residual parts of this civilization. The lore in Anatolia, which is Turkey, the lore across the Ionian coast up from Lebanon through what is today Constantinople, or today Istanbul, that whole culture and that whole lore tends to support these conclusions as well. So it looks as if at about 3000 BC, there were nomadic invasions and others that came down and wiped out the last remnants of these women-centered cultures. And probably,
how long ago?
That would have been as early as 3000 BC, that the destruction began. And we have folklore from what's now Turkey, where men got their title for the land. Midas. Remember the story of Midas, the mm-hmm. King Midas. Well, Midas got his title by sleeping with the goddess. It was the goddess or the female or the feminine through which the title to property came. And that's a repeated, over and over repeated story in that old mythology, so that it appears that early on the property systems were dramatically different. That property in the old order came down through, as it does with the Navajos and Hopis, came down through the female line. And that what the big shift that occurred with the Greeks in the biblical times was that property would now descend through the males.
So what was the basis of their economy? How did they live?
They had a combination of hunting, fishing, and trade. The Minoan civilization traded from the Black Sea to Gibraltar. So, and we found their pots all over from Egypt to what's now Spain. All over Greece. So they were a great trading culture and gradually increasingly wealthy. This was not primitive. This was they had running water in their palaces. Quite interestingly, you asked about what was different. Another aspect that was different was that there was no celebration of or amplification of war as the central value. So these palaces, then there were a number of them in Crete and Santorini that we've been able to excavate, they were without fortifications. Their water systems were brought in from miles away, so that you can't do that if you've got a siege expectation. You got to have your water source where the castle is.
Right, but you also, I mean, you're on an island, so your fortification is the ocean, no?
Your first fortification is the ocean, which is quite useful, and that's probably why these civilizations lasted longer on the islands than they did on the mainland, either in Asia or in Europe. These were the last, the ones we've uncovered now are the last. And some of this, the reason this is not general knowledge is that some of this archaeology has only been uncovered in the last 40 years. So that there was a huge volcanic explosion in 1500 BC, which buried the island of Santorini, and we under 30 meters of ash. 30 meters, that's a lot of ash.
That's a lot of meters.
That's a lot of meters, a lot of ash. And it's only in the last, in the 1960s, that we've dug up some of this material. And it's only because of that ash that's been preserved. So whereas this kind of pottery and this kind of archaeology probably existed from Israel, today's Israel, to Lebanon, to Syria, to Turkey, that all got wiped out over time, but it didn't get wiped out under 30 meters of ash. So that's why we're just now beginning to rediscover this miraculous attention to whatever it is we mean by the feminine. We ought to talk about that too.
We're talking to Craig Barnes. He's the author of the book In Search of the Lost Feminine, Myths That Radically Reshaped Civilization. And by the way, he will be speaking tomorrow night, Friday at 7 o'clock at the Forum at the College of Santa Fe. Well, yeah, so go for it. What is the feminine? Again, that's one of those, for me, red flags, because it's often a way of just trying to keep women in roles.
Well, it could be. It could be. And the thing that it seems to me that's really important is that we understand that we're talking about a worldview, that in this worldview that declined at 1500, it was the last example of which we saw abundantly in 1500 BC, there was this combination of values, a celebration of life, a celebration of as if life were the most important value, so that things that die, and not life by itself, but life as a combination with death, life in a cycle, life as a balance, life and death as a balance. That's an important, that would be a very important value for us today, instead of merely thinking of death as over, or merely thinking of the planet as non-refueling or non-recycling. If we could come to grips with the idea that what we do returns, that death is not final, that death produces some, like the wheat seed. If the model were the wheat seeds, you plant it in the ground dead and it comes up in the spring, that's a much different model than you die, you're dead, and your only way you can get to heaven is through one of these religious practices or another. So
it sounds an awful lot like the doctrine of karma and reincarnation.
It certainly shares some of the same same attitudes, although it's not dependent on your good works, or if you live an appropriately Buddhist life, you would be reincarnated at a higher level. That we don't see that in this archaeology. What we see is that from death inevitably comes life, so that death is not such an evil. It's seminal. It brings life. It's necessary for the return of life. And that's a different concept. So that what good would it do then to kill armies of people? What could it do? Wipe out if the natural result is that they're going to return, if the dead return. And that old story of Jason and the Golden Fleece, remember there's a story there where Jason goes off and he's about to get the Golden Fleece, and he has to kill a dragon. He kills a dragon and he throws the dragon's teeth in the ground, and up from the dragon's teeth come these warriors. Well, that's part of that old myth. You kill some warriors, you throw the teeth in the ground, you plant them, and boom, you get more warriors. So that would be a pretty good example from, and the Greeks saying to you, this is the danger of the old mythology. You get new warriors every time you kill them. So you don't have a civilization here that's celebrating warriors, celebrating war, or living off of war, unfortified palaces, etc. Now, to take your earlier point of skepticism, which is absolutely appropriate, one would have to say, well, maybe they had war. Maybe that was the central thing, and then what's the evidence of that? And so you have to
look. Well, hang on. I don't know. How did you... I mean, the point we were making a moment ago about stereotyping the feminine, that doesn't have anything to do necessarily with war. I mean, the question is, what constitutes the feminine? And you know, it's so easy to get into some kind of like 70s goddess-centered feminist nonsense when you start talking about how women are cyclical and, you know, women are peaceful and things like that.
Well, it's a combination of these circumstances that seem to have characterized this culture in which this collection of values is celebrated. We can't say very much more than that. Ecstasy is celebrated, female sexuality is celebrated, an absence of war war is not celebrated, that the return is celebrated, that cycles are celebrated. So I don't know if one wants to say, well, the feminine is gorgeous, but I think that that combination of values which suggests an entirely different focus on how we survive, what we mean by the survival of life, is worth noting. Some of the literature in the early 90s went way too far, as you're suggesting. The goddess was central and everybody worshipped the goddess and there was only the goddess and we ought to get back to the goddess. I don't think we can say that. What we can say is that a separate collection of values was once at the center of a long-lasting civilization which produced economic success and which is unquestionably was unquestionably there.
So how did it decline and fall?
The first series of things. One, the volcano in 1500, which simply literally blew up the civilization at its center in the island of Tyre or Santorini, created a tidal wave that swept across the Crete, wiped out Crete, a 90-meter-high tidal wave that just swept up the coast and took out the palace of Knossos and Malia on the northern shore of Crete, and sent it in dust and ash cloud to Greece and to Egypt and interrupted the seasons. If your faith was in the cycles of the seasons and the earth and the reproductive quality, and all of a sudden the earth goes out of whack and doesn't produce the wheat in the spring because it's under ash, something's wrong with
so
Mother
much
Earth.
For Mother Nature,
so
Mother
much
Earth.
For Mother Earth. Wait yeah. a minute, whoa! The whole psychological construct would have been devastated. And right after that, that's 1450 BC. We start getting pottery shards at Knossos with the names of Zeus and Poseidon and Hades. Zeus, the thunder god, which boom sends the lightning bolts down, and Poseidon, which is the god of the sea, and we've had this huge tidal wave and death, and Hades, the god of death, and all of a sudden death becomes irremediable, endless, dark, and those three gods replace the earlier centrality. We don't know, there were no mother gods or known goddesses in this earlier culture. There weren't any names. It was more as if we're talking about the way the earth works, the way the cycles work. We weren't talking about the embodiment of a god.
Well, we don't know whether there's names or not because there's no writing.
Oh, yeah, we have a lot of pictures, though, and on the Greek pictures we have always... which come shortly thereafter, there the gods are named, the goddesses are named. We see gods, Athena's named, Artemis's named, Zeus's named, all of those. There's writing, and there was writing. There is a linear A script. We just haven't been able to translate it yet. But there was writing for the pots and the pottery at that time. But there's no writing in identifying these central women. There's no sort of worship of a single individual. It's more the process that seems to be celebrated, the process of continuation.
So it's interesting that in the Greek culture, which of course is a long period of time that we're talking about, but that supplanted the whole Minoan culture, there are traces that you talk about in the book of the former value system that is found in Greek art.
Yes, of course. The Greeks didn't just totally wipe out this Minoan culture. They preempted it, they co-opted it, they involved it. So a goddess like Athena, for example, has still, when she shows up in the Greek mythology, she's both the goddess of wisdom and of war. She's got a snake around her belly. She carries a shield and has a snake. Both of these are old symbols, old fertility symbols, and early and then new war symbols. Hera, the goddess who's supposed to be Zeus's wife, she has been a goddess of the seasons, a celebration of this combination of life and death. That's how the world is. It's got life and death. But she then becomes the shrewish, bitchy, demonic wife of Zeus, who gets folded into the Zeus hierarchy by being the goddess of marriage. But she, her earlier role was as a goddess of the seasons and of the balance. So the Greeks say, okay, we're going to make you the goddess of marriage, and she then bedevils great Greek heroes like Heracles and Achilles and people like that. She befriends almost nobody.
There's a chapter in your book called The Great Civil War Over Marriage. What was that?
That's the Trojan War, 1225 BC. Just in this period of transition from the old culture, the old women-centered culture, need for sons is becoming abundant. You've got to have sons to do long-term, long-distance trade. You've got to have sons to do war, and the need for sons was replacing the need for women for daughters. And men who became rich in these trading cultures and piracy cultures, like Odysseus, the great pirate, the men who became central didn't want to leave their property to somebody else's son. They didn't want to leave it to, and if the women had many partners, they couldn't tell, which is probably true in the old culture, they couldn't tell who would be their son. So they had to somehow get women sequestered in marriage. They had to lock them up. They had to know that the sons to whom they let this great wealth would be their own sons. So in order to do that, there was a huge series of wars from about 1450 to about 750 BC, and these wars established patriarchy. Well, one of these, and the central one, the threshold one, was the Trojan War in 1225. What's it about? It's about marriage. It's about Helen, who's the queen of Sparta, and she gets and falls in love with the prince of Troy, and she and he run off and have a tryst. And that's okay with the people of Troy because they participate in the old culture. It's not so great for the people of Sparta because they are increasingly patriarchal, and they need to keep track of their sons.
So in the old culture, you actually didn't have marriage between a man and a woman, and you didn't know who the father of the children were?
We can't say it as categorically as that. We know that there were pairings, but we see a great deal of evidence of women's female sexuality being celebrated without the restraints that patriarchal systems hold. And then when we get to the biblical literature, the Hebrew literature, we see the early stories condemning the temple priestesses, condemning women who may have had multiple partners, which would have been the temple priestesses, so that the whole term "son of a bitch" comes from the bitches who had multiple male partners, and that goes all the way back to 750 BC in the Greek lore.
So, would you actually draw a connection between women having multiple male partners and having a non-warrior society?
They're related. I don't know if it's a causal connection, but the need to be able to tell, there are a couple of links in the middle there. A patriarchal property system requires that the fathers know who their sons are. You can't have a line from son to son to son without knowing who's my son.
Right.
And you can't know that if your wife or partner has multiple other male partners. So marriage becomes an absolute central institution. And then in order to protect marriage or corral it or maintain it, there was resistance. There was clearly resistance, as in Troy, where the kings and queens of Troy didn't mind if Paris came home with another woman or the woman came home with another Paris. So that there was a battle, a central battle in Western civilization over this issue of whether or not women would be able to choose their partners. And the outcome, according to Homer, was that we not only got Helen back, we wiped out the women like Cassandra, the princess of Troy, and subordinate them, turn them into slaves for the Greek warriors. So sex slaves in some cases, queens in other cases, but house slaves. So that all the Greeks from that time forward who were told this story by Homer knew what the proper role of women was and knew that the heroes in the Trojan War, Achilles and Agamemnon, would be heroes that we Greeks would worship because they had established this patriarchal system.
We're talking to Craig Barnes, author of In Search of the Lost Feminine. So one of the other things that you do in your book is really trace some of the ways in which the Greek myths that supplanted the Minoan myths are with us today. And you gave an example at the beginning of the show of the, you know, nurses not being able to earn as much money as they deserve and so on. What are some of the other ways in which Greek mythology is really with us in our society today?
We struggle abundantly, for example, with domestic violence in this culture still. The number of hospital emergency room entries for women who have been subjected to domestic violence is off the charts, and they are that is a result of a culture which, if you trace down all the way from the Greeks through the Middle Ages, systematically said that women, if they didn't do what a husband said they should do, you should first reason with them, and if they still didn't do it, you should beat them and put them in their right place. That's right through Aquinas. That's right through from Aristotle. It comes all the way down through this line, and that happens still today. There are still cultures which think, not cultures, we have it in our own society here. Go to the Rape Crisis Center in Santa Fe, and women who are beaten are you know, parading in the doors every day. My wife used to be a psychotherapist here, worked at the Rape Crisis Center. And my God, the stories she would bring home of the beatings of women, and that the trouncing of women's intelligence is still abundant. So a place like the Santa Fe Girls' School, where you take a young woman at the sixth grade, seventh grade level, eighth grade level, and reinforce her ability to have her own identity separate from the property system, separate from the patriarchal norms, is terrifically important. So we have it coming up in the glass ceiling, of course, that everybody knows about and talks about. We have it in a latent underline. Wherein lies the fury with which Hillary Clinton was met when she first came into office, the first 6 weeks when she was in office, when her husband was in office in 1992. The fury about Travelgate, the fury about a woman directing a healthcare study. Where does that fury come from? It comes from the same place that the that underlying fear of women that I dealt with in the nurse's suit all these years ago.
So when you say fear of women, what are people scared of?
It's a wonderful question. And since this book, In Search of the Lost Feminine, so many men and I have had this conversation, and I remember very well a man saying to me, "We're just dead, cold out, in terror." In part, it has to do with a loss of power. In part, it has to do with this old image of Aphrodite. Women have the power to take us over. You know, we become infatuated. We become, as if from some celestial goddess, we start to lose our mind. We start to become irrational. That happens to men about like the frog who sticks his tongue out to catch the fly. Well, a man sees a pretty girl walking by, boom, well, where did that come from? And thanks.
So the Minoans didn't have that problem?
They did have that problem, but they didn't resist it in the same way. They didn't demonize it, apparently. We don't see any evidence of them demonizing it. We don't see any evidence of their horror about it. So we don't have the stories like the Siren story or the Sphinx story. The Sphinx story had to do with women's knowledge. If women will offer you knowledge and then, boom, chew you up, eat you alive, and leave you putrid and dead on the rocks. That's the same thing that Eve was trying to do. She was trying to reach for the tree of knowledge, and boom, she got told where to be. So we must have some fear of women's intelligence combined with their sexuality. I can remember when I was first appearing in court with attractive women opposite me, thinking, this is unfair. They're not only smart and brilliant, but they're also attractive. And so there was a kind of, I think that's part of it that underlies men's response, getting used to the fact that we have to share power, we share intelligence, we share the cycles of the seasons, we share child rearing, not childbearing, all of that.
Have you come across cultures in which you don't find that kind of fear of women, which seems to me awfully culturally bound, and just irrational, and also not necessary.
It's certainly not necessary, and one of the things we haven't talked about that has reinforced that in our society So there was the need to keep the patriarchal line and the patrilineal succession going, yes, yes, yes. But another thing that really embedded all of this for us in Western civilization were the storytellers, people like Homer, who gave and stories like the Genesis story in the Bible, which elevate this subordination to the level of religion. And say, okay, God proclaimed this. Well, I mean, we see it, of course, in Islam, the elevation of the subordination of women. Some parts of Islam, there's some contradictions within the Quran, but some parts of Islam that say the subordination of women is absolutely appropriate. Why do they do that? Why do the storytellers do that? In order to reinforce a very shaky ground. So that's one of the other additional things that has added to it. So that down with the burning of Joan of Arc, for example, she's burned after a combination of stories about the carnal lust of Eve and the natural carnal lust of women in general from Greek mythology is displayed before the court. How bad is that? Well, it's so bad, we take an unnatural woman who's strong in war and who's led the French to victories. That's pretty dangerous, so we're going to burn her, and they burned her alive. That has happened over and over throughout history. So there's some deep thing in there, but it's reinforced by the story. So what we need to do as we get to this point in our history is restructure, retell the story, that humans aren't necessarily destined to have women and men in this conflict. There have been cultures in which it was not so. Men are not necessarily supposed to go to bed lonely at night, afraid to show any weakness when they're afraid of the things that are coming the next day. Think of that. Of course, women have suffered awfully. The number of women burned at the stake is something in the millions, perhaps, probably. That's the horrific tale. But there are also men down through the generations of time who've been unable to share because they're not supposed to, because they're supposed to know everything. They're not supposed to be afraid. They're not supposed to not know how to do what they're going to do the next day. Well, shall we rehabilitate them as well? Yeah, let's have whole human beings on both sides of this equation and try to recreate a more balanced, more healthy conversation.
So do we know any of the Minoan myths? I mean, we certainly know the Greek myths, and we read them since the first grade. Do we know the actual any of the Minoan myths?
We do not. We do not. We simply do not. All we can do is attempt to recreate the things that a clear picture, an intelligent picture of the things that they focused on, the things that they concentrated on. One of the most interesting, Mary Charlotte, you probably be interested in this. There are a number of Minoan images of where men and where the figures represent several things. There's a seal ring, a little tiny seal ring in which displays a woman, a woman's body, but she has a bird tail and bird's wings and a beehive head. Now that's not inscrutable. That's not nonsense. That's obviously a codified message, and it happens over and over with different kinds of things. So what is it that's consistent about a beehive head, a bird's wings, and a woman's body? This is a bird with breasts. This is a bird with a beehive head. What is it that the bee symbolizes, that the bird symbolizes, that the human females? And that gives us a method of analysis which is a little different than saying the thing that you were objecting to earlier. Oh, well, we had goddesses, and goddesses are at the center, and ain't it great we had goddesses? This is not that. We have to look at those analytically and say, all right, they weren't, obviously those symbols weren't combined in order to contradict each other. They're sending a message as clear as writing if we could figure it out.
If
we could figure it out. Well, if you can only see one, you can't. If you only see two, you can't. If you only see three, you can't. But if you see dozens or hundreds of these combined symbols, then you say to yourself, there is a message here, and what is it that's consistent all together as a whole? And that's when we begin to see messages about female sexuality, about ecstasy, about cycles of the seasons, and about the whole principle of rebirth as a central principle.
And on that note, Craig Barnes, I'd like to thank you so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Great to see you. Thank you.
Craig Barnes is the author of In Search of the Lost Feminine, Myths That Radically Reshaped Civilization, and he will be speaking tomorrow night at 7 o'clock at the College of Santa Fe Forum in a benefit for the Santa Fe Girls School. Stay tuned. We're going to be speaking about women in film in just a moment. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Janet Davidson. She's past president of New Mexico Women in Film and here to tell us about the New Mexico Women in Film special Women's Day event this Saturday. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. I'd actually like to start because I was thinking this morning, I read something that said, why do we still need a Women's Day? And I realized
we just spent the last 45 minutes talking about that on this show.
I wish I'd been able to hear. I was driving around the snow. I think that the key to this is international. It's that we may be doing all right, or we may be thinking that we're all right, but the international picture of women is sometimes very dismal and very frightening, and they need support. And for as many people as can come together with events that celebrate women and celebrate what our accomplishments are and can be, that helps other people. I read just this morning Malaysia is having an International Women's Day for the first time ever. China has joined in with International Women's Day, which is Saturday, March 8th. And so when you get this global message going about women, it's just empowering, and it's a wonderful, wonderful feeling.
So there are a whole bunch of films by women. Are they all short films?
They're all short films, and what happens is this is the third year that Women in Film International, which is a global, it started in Los Angeles, grew to New York, and now is global. I think there's 45 chapters around the world. New Mexico Women in Film, it was the 38th chapter, and we've been around now for almost 3 years. For 3 years, they've been doing these film festivals. And various women submit their short films to film festivals around the country and around the globe. The winners from these particular film festivals then get sent to Women in Film International. They make their choice on 90 minutes or whatever of films that they then send out to each chapter. Each chapter then makes a decision whether they want to show all the films or whether they want to add some of their own. We, in fact, are adding two New Mexico winners.
From New Mexico's burgeoning film industry.
Oh, I have to tell you, this, what started 3 years ago, we held the same competition. One of our winners, Kate Bush, went on to win the Hamptons Film Festival and ended up in the International last year. So we're well represented, and they're actually very proud of New Mexico. And so we are going to be adding two of our films to this Saturday night's event. But I just wanted to read you briefly the kind of participation that just this Saturday alone has. This Saturday, they'll be showing these films in Calgary, in Edmonton, Atlanta, Copenhagen, Denmark, Montreal, Boston, Santa Fe, Pittsburgh, St. John's.
So the same films are going to be seen all over the world.
Minnesota, Palm Springs, Vancouver, Washington,
heavens,
and then on and on. So at that same day, we will be coming together collectively to celebrate these. And I have to tell you, I've seen the films, obviously. They are the best they have been. They are wonderful films.
Now, it's March, Saturday, March 8th, from 6 to 10, 4 hours worth
of
short films?
Well, no, what we do is we open the doors at 6 at the Film Center, and there's still tickets available over there at the Film Center. It's $9 for members.
We don't talk prices on the air, but that's
okay. Okay. Well, anyway, you can go over there and get it and get the tickets. We have 6 o'clock the doors open, 7 o'clock the films start, and then afterwards we have champagne and dessert so you can network with other filmmakers, not just women.
Other lovers of film.
Other lovers of film. You'll love these films. These are the best I've seen in a long time. They really are.
Janet Davidson of New Mexico Women in Film, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, Good Morning Jazz with John Greenspan features Artist of the Month for March, guitarist Herb Ellis. And on Sunday at 4 o'clock, the Forum on KSFR features Bill Stewart, Ed Brown, and Greg Bemis discussing the elections and the Israeli-Gaza situation, moderated by John Greenspan. All this and much, much more on KSFR, Santa Fe's only public radio station, 101.1 FM, broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company. My name is Mary Charlotte. Tomorrow, the inevitable and inimitable Robert Knott and author Amy Irvin will be here as well. So, see you later. Ciao.